heard my child in prayer, and for me some scarlet ribbons for my hair. All the stores were closed and shuttered. All the streets were dark and bare. In our town, no scarlet ribbons, not one ribbon for her hair. Through the night, my heart was aching. Just before the dawn was breaking, I peeked in, and on her bed in gay profusion lying there, lovely ribbons for her hair. If I live to be a hundred, I will never know from where lovely scarlet ribbons for her hair.
That was the inimitable Harry Belafonte with one of my favorite Christmas songs, one that doesn't get played as often as most, Scarlet Ribbons. This is our last show before Christmas. Of course, if the most current rash of apocalypse prophets are right, the world will end tomorrow, making this the last show ever. But, Lorraine and I plan to visit my 97-year-old mom tomorrow night with a bunch of folks from our church and sing Christmas carols. And although I'm not expecting that to be the last night of the world or of my life, I guess it'd be an appropriate way to spend it if it turned out that way. I fully expect to be here talking to you next week, though. But that'll be after Christmas, so I thought I'd share Mr. Belafonte's song with you tonight. A song of affirmation, of God or a higher power, if you prefer that term, intervening to make two people very happy, one for receiving a gift, the other for giving it or having it given on their behalf or appearing up. Well, you know what I mean. The gift of giving. That's why it's such a favorite of mine. Now, there's a wonderful story by O. Henry, that's another of my favorite things this season. The Gift of the Magi tells of a young couple so obsessed with the idea of giving each other the perfect gift that they sacrifice the material thing they hold most dear. She gives up her hair to buy him a chain for his gold watch. He gives up his gold watch to buy her a brooch for her hair. Of course, what they're really giving and receiving is their love for one another. And we can all learn from that. Instead of huge buying sprees, we'd all do much better by giving of ourselves, by visiting or volunteering or calling or whatever we can come up with to share a little bit of happiness with those that we love. Or, for that matter, share a little happiness with some people you don't even know. They need it, too. Some of them probably need it a lot more than those people that we do know and love. And now, let me make an even more radical suggestion. Think of a way to share some happiness with somebody that you hate. You'll find you get a lot more from forgiving them than you do from holding that grudge forever. I think we could all do a lot better by sharing love and happiness instead of hate and aggravation and greed. We here on this show try to provide a positive message to tell you the things that we can all do to help make a better world. We often get lost in the bad things. Let's remember it's the good things that make our life better. Let's listen now to Bill Hicks.
Just a ride. And we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace.
And now, coming to you live from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in Duluth, Minnesota, Dreaming the New American Dream, with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Pelichek.
We're glad that you joined us tonight for the show. I'm Chuck Gregory, and I'm going to turn things over now to my friend and co-host, Mike Pelichek, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome special guests Paul Gianfrido and Fred Johnson. And so tonight we're gathering together for the New American Dream radio show in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, Lake Worth, Florida, Duluth, and wherever you are. There are no wrong questions. We might not know all the answers yet, but it is never wrong to ask a question that we have. That is the premise upon which the New American Dream is founded. And now we have to ask questions about the recent school shooting in Connecticut. Would our own United States government take part in such an atrocity in order to bring about a sense of fear in society? And if so, why? Why would that sense of fear be so important to them to do such a thing? There are many good questions about the shooting itself to be found at Veterans Today if you look up Kevin Barrett's latest two articles. One is entitled, Who Really Killed the Connecticut Children? And another is entitled, Questions About the Connecticut School Shooting. As with all the big stories flogged by the American media, the various avenues of the U.S. press fell quickly in line behind this story, deftly avoiding any evidence that would tend to cast doubt on the official version of events. So while there has been some minor quibbling over insignificant details of the story, few serious journalists have questioned the central thesis that the carnage that day was the work of the two acting alone. That's Dave McGowan writing in 2000 about the shooting at Columbine High School. And since that time, we have had probably dozens of these very similar events. Some of them were the Virginia Tech shooting, Fort Hood, the Sikh temple shooting in Milwaukee, the Tucson, Arizona shooting of the congresswoman and others, the Pentagon gunman, the Aurora, Colorado theater shooting. For a list, go to Mother Jones Online. It's entitled A Guide to Mass Shootings in America. Maybe it is mental illness, guns, people getting fed up with bullies and exploding, but I think that there's just too much of a pattern here to be content with that explanation. I think rather than following our own pattern of saying lone nut every time and never getting past that, I think the time has come to say government, CIA, FBI, and then prove it was not, and then go on from there. Remember the D.C. sniper, the underwear bomber, the shoe bomber, September 11th, Oklahoma City? How about the burial of Osama bin Laden at sea? The illustrated tall tale of Jessica Lynch, the lies about Pat Tillman, the stolen presidential elections of 2000 and 2004, Bush wasn't even a real president. Think of that. Weapons of mass destruction, Colin Powell at the UN. And a decade earlier, the lie about Iraqi soldiers taking babies out of incubators and leaving them to die, which helped lead to the first Gulf War. The lies about why Pearl Harbor really happened. The lies about the circumstances around the death of Senator Paul Wellstone. The lies about the whole history of the United States, for starters. Gulf of Tonkin, which means the whole Vietnam War and why it was fought was a lie. Landing on the moon. Have you ever watched the YouTube press conference video of the returning Apollo 11 astronauts? Now might be a good time. How many Native Americans did we slaughter in order to raise our free and brave flag in San Francisco? The war on drugs, where we lock up people for decades for possession of a plant. And we love our beer commercials and our beer in the meantime. The war on immigrants. They are illegal, we cry from atop the Statue of Liberty in Ellis Island. Look up Operation Northwoods in Iran-Contra, the confession of E. Howard Hunt. Watch George Bush Sr.'s little speech at the Gerald Ford funeral on YouTube. It's just all a supreme joke when you get right down to it. The United States of America, that is. Does that all really relate back to the shooting of children in Connecticut? I think it does. I do think it is absolutely all connected. Just as I think the murders of John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King are connected to today, this morning, tonight. The ones who did those crimes and hid them are still here, still in control, still running their scam, motioning everyone up closer and closer to the stage, telling us it's really a fantastic concert. And actually, it is a hanging. They are now doing crimes like killing children because they know we will then allow them to tighten the noose. We don't even see the rope. And they are very capable of pulling that trap door without us knowing the door is even there until it is too late. Well, there is a place like no place on earth, a land full of wonder, mystery, and danger. Some say to survive it, you need to be mad as a hatter. And if you come to understand this mad place, the others will tell you that you are entirely bonkers. But I'll tell you a secret. All the best people are. Back to you, Chuck.
Just in, this late breaking news brief. The House Un-American Activities Committee will be reconvening next week. The committee will be investigating un-American activities such as the murder of children in Iraq and Afghanistan, the restricting of personal freedoms through the so-called Patriot Act, the infiltration of American organizations by members of clandestine terror groups. Are you now, or have you ever been, a member of the Central Intelligence Agency? Appearing next week before the committee will be Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, Matt Lauer, Katie Couric, Diane Sawyer, Brian Williams, and Wolf Blitzer. And also, for what reason, we have no idea. We would also like to shout out to those men and women serving in 10,000 countries and municipalities, islands, peninsulas, knolls, glens, gullies, inlets, deltas, fjords, and firths overseas. Serving in Berlin and Aachen and Baden and Fufen and Mummum and Dorf and Dierdorf and Daden and Dasher and Prancer and Donder and Blitzen. We need you. For what reason, we have no idea, but thank you for all you do, and we're pleased to send you 50% of our tax dollars. For what reason, we have no idea. But because you're there and they thank you at ball games and on beer commercials, we thank you for all you do. For what reason, we have no idea.
Box cutters, cave dwellers, jet fuel bringing down steel structures. They hate us because of our freedoms. Anyone who is not with us is against us. Osama bin Laden has been buried at sea. The CIA is known as the company. CIA agents are called assets. The CIA for the past 60-some years, 70 years, has killed, murdered, cheated, lied, duped, fooled, and disrupted anyone working anywhere for fairness for the poor. The CIA is the arm of American business. President John F. Kennedy saw this and said he was going to dismantle the CIA. They killed him, and then they fooled you, all of us. And we pay for the CIA with our tax dollars. We do not storm the CIA building and tear it down brick by brick. Box cutters, cave dwellers. Osama bin Laden confessing on some tape somebody said somebody found somewhere. Anthrax. Paul Wellstone's plane has crashed in a forest. Robert Kennedy murdered, never became president. They would not allow him to be able to investigate his brother's murder. Martin Luther King murdered, never brought poor people to occupy Washington to demand justice for the poor, taking money out of the pockets of the rich. Poverty is not the problem, it is the solution. The business of America is business. The CIA, the fist of American business for over 70 years. Apple pie, Chevrolet, baseball, grandma, and the CIA.
Our first guest tonight is Paul Gianfrido. He's been a mayor of Middletown, Connecticut, and served as a legislator in Connecticut for many years, as well as being a very successful businessman. But we're more interested tonight in some of that legislative experience. Paul, welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, I was the last time that we had you, we discussed some of the things that went wrong in the laws having to do with the dealing of with mental health. It seems, you know, Connecticut laws about mental health might be a very hot topic right now in light of the recent school shootings in Newtown.
Well, a lot of people do consider or think that there's a link between mental illness and violence, and I and others spend an awful lot of time trying to tell people and inform them that people with mental illness are more likely to be the victims than the perpetrators of violence, and so that we all have a common interest in trying to resolve sort of in our own minds, you know, what happened there and how it is that we might be able to prevent things like that in the future.
Well, my personal experience certainly bears out that idea that the people with the problems are more likely to be victims than the perpetrators. You had posted something that I thought was very interesting on Facebook, where you were discussing a special. Well, let me read it or part of it, and let you and get you to talk about it.
Okay.
He said, Whenever a parent or a school believes that a special education student needs to be removed from his school, either by a suspension, expulsion, or voluntary removal for behavioral reasons, for at least 5 consecutive days or at least 10 days in the course of a school year, there must be a mediation scheduled with the school district. This your proposal here had to do with something that actually happened in Newtown. Is that correct?
Well, it has to do with something that you know, has happened in many cases, and it's something that I had read occurred with Adam Lanza, who was the shooter there, that at one point in his time in school, his mother had pulled him out of school to homeschool him. And then the reason for that that was given was that there were, you know, essentially difficulties in school. I mean, a lot of this, nobody talks very much about what the details or circumstances were. So I'm not intentionally talking around it. It's just I read that he was pulled out. She homeschooled, and the reason he was pulled out was were for behavioral reasons. And I found that to be something of a common denominator with a lot of other children who have got behavioral health illnesses, mental illnesses in particular, that often there is a time when either the school suspends them because of bad behavior, they're breaking the rules, or parents just up and out, you know, distraught with services not being provided, pull the kids out of school. And this idea that I have is a way to try to break this chain, which I think is a link in a chain that often leads to bad outcomes by the time these children become adults.
Can you explain a little bit more in a little bit more detail what you have in mind?
Yeah, sure. And to back up what I said when I talked about the last time I was on the show a couple months back, like 3 or 4 months back, was that I think there are policy mistakes that have been made that often lead to bad outcomes in the lives of children with mental illness. And mental illness, serious mental illness, is in fact a disease of children. 50% of people get mental illness before the age of 14. And,
wow.
And what has to happen, I think, for there to be bad outcomes, for them to become victims of violence, for them to become homeless, for them to themselves commit violent acts, is usually a chain of events that occur over 10 or 20 years or more. And I believe that strongly, that with changes in policy, better prevention and early detection, for example, we can break that chain in various places, which would allow us, frankly, to continue to make most of the policy mistakes we make. But if we just didn't make all of them, we could address that problem. This one really looks at the middle of the chain. It looks at that time in a child's life, usually several years into illness, sometimes though before they're diagnosed, but often several years before the worst outcome happens, whatever that's going to be for the child, that their behavior gets so bad at some point in the school that the school says, we're going to suspend them, or that the parents say, we're going to pull them out. And with children who are otherwise stigmatized, isolated, you know, struggling in school, the worst thing you can do, frankly, is to take them out of that environment. So this idea was to say that before you do that, and again, I speak kind of personally of this because it's an experience I had with my own son that I wrote about, before you have to pull them out or before you pull them out, we should go to an immediate mediation instead. And what they should do is bring in the child's pediatrician, bring in the child's mental health provider from the community, because oftentimes what happens in the school, there's no relationship to what's going on in the community, and they don't listen to or include those community professionals, mental health professionals who have been working with the child in developing or implementing a child's education plan. And so this says, go to mediation, bring those people in, write the changes that are needed, and if 2 of the 3 parties agree, the school would be one of them, the parents would be the second, and the state would be the third. If 2 of the 3 agree on what needs to be done, it should become an immediate part of the child's plan, and the state should pick up the cost, not the parents, not the local school district. If the parents are not one of the parties that agree, then I'm saying the parents should still have the right to go to due process, which is a right we have under the law to challenge the whole program and have an impartial decision maker, hearing officer, make a decision about what should happen. But it just strikes me that instead of just saying, as was said in the case of my son and has been said in the case of so many other children who have mental illnesses and in school, if they would only just behave, if they would only just follow the rules, if they would only do what they're supposed to, this wouldn't happen. Or I'm treating them just like I'd be treating every other student in this case. Well, the problem is, you know, you can't treat somebody with cancer like somebody who doesn't have cancer. And mental illness is a chronic disease that costs as much as cancer. It takes more years of life away from people than cancer does. Yet we insist on trying to treat it the same way we treat people as if, when they don't have mental illness. And it just doesn't work. And this is the evidence we get over and over again. It just doesn't work.
Yes, we insist on treating it by ignoring it or pretending it doesn't exist until something is so bad that then we say, okay, well, in this case, we'll just have to lock them up.
Exactly. Then we blame them. I mean, isn't that ironic? That's exactly what happens. We treat it for the longest time as if it doesn't exist. We ignore it. We neglect it. We neglect them. We isolate them. And then when something blows, then we say, okay, lock them up. And that's no solution. That's not the way we treat any other chronic disease. And at one level, all mental illnesses are chronic diseases of the brain.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing your insights with us here. What you say makes a great deal of sense, and I hope somebody that's still in the legislatures or somewhere in one or more states picks up on it and tries to make it happen.
I hope so, too. I mean, I think that if they look at the front end, there's a lot more we can do in prevention through early screening and detection in children. Every child should be screened for mental illness as a part of well-child exams, just as we screen them for a lot of other common conditions, because this is a common condition. The idea is not to stigmatize them or not to lock them up. It's just to identify disease at an early stage. That's why we have well-child exams, and to make sure that we mitigate symptoms as early as we can. So we can intervene there at low cost. We can intervene here when they're in school. We can intervene when they're adults by taking money from jails and prisons and putting it into community mental health services. The point is, though, we have to intervene somewhere. So I thank you for calling attention to this, and hopefully people will recognize and advocate that whether you want to do it at the front end, the middle, or the back end, we've got to do it, and we've got to do it somewhere, because what we're doing now just isn't working.
Paul, in closing, I'd like you to tell people where they can find you on the web. I know that you have a couple of different sites where you post, and one that's your own. So please tell the people where to find you.
Sure. I can be found at Our Health Policy Matters. That's the name of my blog. It's a mental health and health policy blog, Our Health Policy Matters. And it's at tgionfrido.blogspot.com.
Thank you for joining us tonight, and I hope that we'll be able to continue this conversation in a few months down the road. And let's hope there's a more positive event that triggers my asking you back instead of the negative one that produced your visit this time.
That'd be great. Thank you. And, let's hope for a more peaceful new year for everybody.
Indeed.
Okay.
Thank you, and have a good night.
You too.
We are proud to be sponsored this week by the Minutemen, guarding Americans' borders from poor people. Our own great-grandparents were poor, and they came here from other places, huddled masses yearning to be free. We are fighting for freedom from poor people, taking aim at frightened lasses crouching by a tree. We urinate on the Statue of Liberty. We defecate on Ellis Island. We've got ours crunched tight in our cold, dead, clammy hands. In just 60 seconds, we are able to desecrate the whole idea of America. We are the Minutemen. Who are they? They say it's going to rain. Have you ever met a they? You probably did not know it, but you could feel it. It's cold, like if there's a ghost in the room. It feels like the creeps. It feels like it feels in a scary movie just before some head appears in the dark window. You might have felt it sitting next to Uncle Bob at the Thanksgiving table. They did 9/11. They control the world. They killed JFK. They killed RFK. They killed Paul Wellstone and Martin Luther King Jr. They control what we see on TV, radio, and in the newspaper. They. This sentence is brought to you by me, sent out to you that we might become we, in the hope that someday we may conquer they.
Our second guest tonight, live right here in my apartment, is Father Fred Johnson. He's a supply priest, and he's commonly preaches at the Church of the Intercession in Fort Lauderdale, where I attend church. And he used to be vicar at the Church of the Intercession in New York City, and I'm going to let him tell you about how he ended up here and that sort of thing. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chuck. I'm Fred Johnson. I'm an Episcopal priest. I was a teacher and priest for a number of years, mostly in New York City, which is where I was when I retired, and I decided I did not want to retire to the cold, so I came down to Fort Lauderdale, which I had visited a few times. It changed my once solemn vow that I would never retire to Florida, and it changed my mind because I came down here for a few vacations and just fell in love with the place. So anyway, I ended up down here and put my name on what we call in our church the supply list. It's not a devious list. It's just it lets the diocese know that you're available as a priest for supplying in churches that for one reason or another need a priest. Either the regular priest is on vacation or has retired, they don't have a replacement yet, whatever. And eventually I got a call from the parish that you know all too well, the Church of the Intercession. It blew my mind because for several decades in New York City I was associated with the Church of the Intercession in New York City. And when I discovered that there was a church down here called the Church of the Intercession, as I say, it blew my mind. So that's how we got to know each other. That's why it is I hold forth right now at the Church of the Intercession. They are, as you know, that parish is without a priest, and so they went to the supply list and found me, I guess, and that's how I ended up there.
Well, we're certainly glad that you did. When you were in New York City, I think you were involved in many ways in social programs and also there was a you've told me something about meeting Archbishop Tutu. Would you be kind enough to share that with our listeners? A little bit of a vignette.
Well, yes, I was being at the Church of the Intercession in New York, I was extremely fortunate. I should say something first about the church itself. It's a fairly old parish by American standards. It was founded, I think, in 1845 or so, quite old. But its current building was not built then. It was built in around between 1912 and 1915, and it's a real jewel of American church architecture. It was designed by one of the two men who reintroduced genuine Gothic to American church architecture. His name is Bertram Goodhue. He's well known for a number of buildings, among them the West Point Chapel, St. Thomas Fifth Avenue, our own Church of the Intercession, and the Nebraska State Capitol, which is the only skyscraper capitol in the United States, the only unicameral legislature, and the only Art Deco capitol in the United States. Because he, as I said, he was responsible for this reintroduction of true, genuine Gothic, but also with another man, he was also responsible for the American version of Art Deco, the other man being Frank Lloyd Wright. Well, anyway, Church of the Intercession vies for the title of Goodhue's own favorite church work. There's another building in New York that claims no there yet, but in any case, as one of the past rectors of the church said, we have the body, because Goodhue is actually buried in a crypt in the wall of the north transept of the church. It's a landmark building, and it sits right on the edge of Harlem. Well, as a result of its location, it's a largely black parish. And to make a long story short, it eventually became what we call the capital of the African diaspora in New York. That was a sort of a title sort of invented by the then rector that I served under for a number of years. We called it that because the Episcopal Church is part of the Anglican Communion, and Anglicanism is pretty big on the continent of Africa. And so whenever the African bishops and archbishops came through New York, they almost always came to the Church of the Intercession. And one of those bishops was then Bishop Tutu, later Archbishop Tutu. As I think I told you, I have a couch in my apartment here, my townhouse here, on which the archiepiscopal posterior rested at one point. He actually took a nap on my couch once, and I thought of having it bronzed, but it's not very practical because it might not be so comfortable. But anyway, I got to meet him a number of times. He came to Intercession a number of times, and as I say, since I lived near the church, on one of those times it happened that he needed to rest between some functions, and he ended up taking a nap at my apartment. So that's sort of a thumbnail sketch of my association with the Archbishop. And actually, a very good friend of mine's son, that wasn't very good grammar, the son of a very good friend of mine, is named for him at my suggestion, and he is that child's godfather. And the young fellow and his mother keep in touch with Archbishop Tutu more than I do. I mean, they're closer to sort of being family friends.
Well, yeah.
So.
I was especially impressed in this last Sunday's sermon by the remarks you were making about the Newtown shooting. And I'm going to ask you to give us a capsule summary of those remarks.
What? You don't want me to go on for hours and hours and repeat the whole sermon?
I'd love to have you go on for the whole sermon, but we only have a 15-minute interview.
Well, actually, even its entirety, it wouldn't be hours and hours, but yes, I'd be happy to. The great Karl Barth was one of the premier theologians of the 20th century. He often said, I think he's the one who said it, he often said the preacher should always preach with the newspaper in one hand and the Bible in the other. So I always try to make sure that my sermons have something to do with what's going on, if there is something of moment going on. I mean, obviously, you don't want to be quite that topical every week. Sometimes you want to talk about broader issues, but sometimes some issues sort of impose themselves, and it seemed to me that last Sunday that was certainly the case. It was the third Sunday of Advent, and so I took the two names that the third Sunday of Advent sort of goes by. One is Gaudete Sunday, which is the Latin word for rejoice. That was because at one time Advent was kind of a mini Lent, and people, you know, fasted and extra praying and all that, as they sometimes do in Lent now. And by the third Sunday, back in the Middle Ages, they decided they needed a little rest. So on the third Sunday, they said Gaudete, rejoice, and they called it Gaudete Sunday. So I talked a little bit about that and about how we need to rejoice. Sometimes we don't rejoice in the moment, in our life, in what we have been given by the Creator, always wanting something else or something different, or, you know, not living in the moment. So I talked a bit about that. But then, especially given the events of the previous week, I also talked about the other name for the sermon, for the Sunday. In the Anglican Communion, it's also called Stir Up Sunday, not named for the article that dangles from a saddle on a horse, but rather named for the first words of the collect for the third Sunday of Advent, which says, Stir up your power, O Lord, and with great might come among us. And then it goes on to ask the Lord to do this and to let his bountiful grace and mercy speedily help and deliver us because, as the collect points out, we are sorely hindered by our sins. And it seemed to me that as the great words of the Book of Common Prayer and other liturgies often do, that sort of spoke to what was going on in our world right now. We do need the divine power to come among us, to be stirred up, because we are sorely hindered by everything that we mess up and do wrong, by our lack of connection with each other and our lack of connection with our divine ground. So, on hitting that, I obviously connected it to the very wrong situation of Newtown. In effect, that we need God to stir up God's power and come among us to help us solve problems like this and prevent problems like this. I, as you remember, because you poor thing, you have to hear this twice. As you remember, I pointed out some statistics, which, came from where your co-host pointed out, came from Mother Jones via NPR. I got it from NPR. But we've had in the last, if I may, I may have these wrong, but this is what I remember. In the last 60 or so years, we've had 31 mass shootings. And it hasn't been getting better. It's been getting worse because the Mother Jones article that Mike pointed out says that 7 of those occurred in the last year. Since then, I've actually heard it was 12 in the last year. And it's getting worse and not better. So to say that we need God to stir up the divine power among us and come among us with his great might is an understatement. I certainly, as I pointed out in the sermon, I certainly believe in and revere the Constitution. I don't think you can play fast and loose with it. If you play fast and loose with it when it gets in the way of something you want or don't want, you know, whichever, something you're trying to cause or something you're trying to prevent, then someone else can also play fast and loose with it when it gets in the way of things you do believe in, you know, that you either want or don't want. So I don't believe in playing fast and loose with it, but I don't believe the Founding Fathers meant the Second Amendment to produce Newtown. I don't think that's what they had in mind. And I think we've got to do something about it. And so the sermon tried to make the point out that if God's power is to be stirred up, it's going to have to be through us. And we're going to have to do something about this and not just have more calls for dialogue that produce nothing and more hand-wringing that produces nothing. With some other illustrations and so on and so forth, that was more or less the burden of the sermon.
Well, I think that's certainly an effective message, but let me ask you this. What changes should we make?
Oh, boy. I listen to NPR a lot, and I must have heard that question asked 50 times in the last 3 or 4 days by every interviewer I listen to.
Sorry, I have to be more original.
And to tell you the truth, that wasn't meant as an accusation. It was just an explanation of my bemusement. And I'm afraid I certainly can't answer better than a lot of the people that were asked that did. But it seems to me some things have to be done. We do have to, I think, get rid of these assault weapons. And I know that the gun lobby, I'll just call it that for want of a better term, is a kind of shorthand. The gun lobby tries to play around with that term and say, oh, these weapons at Newtown weren't really assault weapons. Well, I've been listening to enough NPR and other things to know that that's just playing with words. They are assault weapons. It's only by the merest technicality that the weapons that young man had aren't assault weapons. We've got to get rid of assault weapons. True, that would not get rid of the local mugger coming up behind you in an alley, and no one says they would. But that's like saying, well, we shouldn't pass laws against drunk driving because someone's still going to go out and get drunk. We have to do what we have to do. So I think that's one. We have to get rid of the assault weapons. The humongous magazines that make the assault weapons be what they are, namely assault weapons, we have to get rid of those, regulate those, control those. And I think we have to, we also have to do more just about regular weapons. That is to say, we have to enforce the laws we have, which are constitutional. Our Supreme Court has declared them so. So we've got to really enforce the ones we have and patch up a few loopholes. I think some common sense things. At the same time, I do think it's a both and not an either or. We also have to look at the mental health component and start putting our money where our mouth is in that respect, as has been already pointed out in today's program. As I was listening to Paul, I was struck by the fact that there are so many sensible things we can do about so many problems, and it seems like we have a habit, an ingrained orientation to always avoid what's sensible. We never seem to be able to get together on the sensible. Now, maybe that's the messiness that is a democracy, and okay, but I think that those of us who agree on the sensible need to make our voice heard a little more strongly and make it possible for some of these common sense solutions to be put into place.
Well, I think we're about out of time at this point, but I thank you so much for joining us tonight and sharing your views. Is there anything that you would like to tell people in closing where they can find you on the web, or if there's some cause that you especially like them to look up and help with, give somebody a shout out here.
Well, I'm not an online person in that sense. I don't have a blog or a site or anything. I'd like, first of all, to say, Gaudete, rejoice that we are in the Advent season and approaching Christmas, so I hope everyone has a wonderful holiday, whatever holiday they celebrate at this time of year. And I hope that we all can get a little more in touch with our divine ground. As far as causes, I mean, there are an awful lot of good causes out there, so I guess I can't really pick one up. But
thank you very much, Fred, and good night.
Indian names for white guys. Sits on sofa. Drinks his beer, eats his chips, mows his lawn, drives his car, goes to work, sits on sofa, goes to bed. That's about it. For this, we raped the land and killed the people. We kill anything that moves to protect our way of life, eating while watching TV in the dark. Yeah, that's right. Indians have some names for white guys.
Nominations are currently being accepted to rename all the places we've named for horrible people. Ronald Reagan National Airport. The 10th Mountain Division Highway, 90th Infantry Division Highway, 173D Airborne Brigade Memorial Highway, Gerald Ford Memorial Highway, George Bush Intercontinental Airport. We're going to name things after famous bad people, and why not? Well, how about Ted Bundy National Cemetery, John Wayne Gacy International Airport, Jeffrey Dahmer Memorial Freeway, Charles Manson Space Needle. Okay, here's a thought. Why not name things for good people instead of terrible people? How about Dan and Phil Berrigan International Airport, Dorothy Day Interstate, the Emma Goldman Freeway? Brought to you by citizens for naming things after good people rather than horrible people.
Well, it's been another long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. A while back, we heard some stories about Kate King, the daughter of Jack Robert King, the local internet radio show host. Well, Jack Robert is long gone, killed by the police, but Kate is still around, and she sent some transcripts of some of her father's radio shows and some homemade notes to tell the story of their family. She sent it to the local newspaper, but they didn't want it, so she sent them on to us. The basement tapes of Looking for Bigfoot Radio and Jack Robert King. And we are proud to be the ones to tell the world the story of a nobody who once existed, Jack Robert King, the story of us all. As we learned in the last few weeks, Jack has left the family in Nebraska and taking a bus, headed to Oregon to look for Bigfoot, to look for the truth about America. He broadcast his radio show along the way.
Good morning, Rocky Flats, maker of plutonium triggers, polluter of the Rockies. Have another good goddamn day in America. Jesus. Workers at Area 51, quit your jobs, walk away if they'll let you. Do it for your country, your world. Of course, I understand that I might as well ask that of the teachers in my wife's school or the folks down at PAMIDA, all just working to make money to live. We should all walk out. Heaven would erupt in joy if we did. We won't. Well, okay. Carry over from yesterday's show. Received a dozen emails regarding my saying that we had to be nonviolent in our struggle. It's true, but some don't agree. What about Cuba, Central America? How do you get anything done for the people, for the poor, for real change, if you don't stand right up to the bad guys? I don't know. But Gandhi had an idea. So did those folks in the Deep South who started the American Civil Rights Movement. Jesus, they worked and suffered and struggled. No guns. I don't know. I see the appeal of guns. How about Pancho Villa? Zapata? That guy is down in Chiapas right now. I'd like to walk right up to some of these folks we have around here with a gun across my chest, sure. But that's not right. So I'm someone who's not disheartened to hear about our military deaths in Iraq, and I thought it was righteous payback for the Twin Towers and Pentagon to get hit. That's when I didn't understand it was our own government did it. I was not appalled by blowing up of the federal building in Oklahoma. Those folks were involved in Waco, well, but I see that as a hardened heart, not a good heart. I want to change. I'd like to have a good heart. You can't ever kill and be right with yourself or the world ever again. I'm not a knee-jerk good person. I have to work very hard at it. I never quite get there. But don't be like me. Be like your Grandpa Pete or your Aunt Jenny. Folks with the big smiles, the candy in the jar right next to the big chair in the living room. Those are the good folks. Go to them. Learn from them. Good morning, Kent State. They sent a message that day, didn't they? Write your letters to the editor. Hold your poster board in the wind on the corner. Flip your peace sign during graduation exercises. But don't you dare threaten us with real change. Hello. This is Bigfoot Radio, coming to you live from the road from Idaho. Ever notice there haven't been any terror alerts since the election? No red or yellow or orange warnings? It means the head of Homeland Security and the head of the FBI got on TV and lied all about it in order to get somebody elected. Exactly what it means. Even if you don't believe anything else I tell you, that's enough reason to stop believing in the myth called America, the American dream. Oh, it's the American dream, all right. None of it's real. Your grandma, your puppy, they're real. Nothing else. Hey there, Roswell, New Mexico, how goes it? What the hell happened in your town in the 1940s anyway? Nothing? Something? Jackie Gleason said that Richard Nixon stopped by his house, drove him personally to see the alien bodies from the crash. Is it true? Will we ever know? Nah. Maybe this morning in Livonia, Georgia, an honest person is being born, and all we need to do is wait. You know, they never were going to tell us the truth about Abu Ghraib, that Bush lied to Congress about weapons of mass destruction, that Colin Powell lied to the United Nations. How many other things are they lying about? You know, even if there's no God and Jesus was just a good guy, do we really know the truth? We think we do. We won't really know until we close our eyes the last time, and it's either, oh, shit, or, oh, boy. But even if there's no forever and ever, no rock and roll heaven, Jesus was a fighter, a rebel, a strong, courageous man who would not kill, who stood for the truth when his family, his church, his government, and his neighbors said, leave us alone, asshole, get yourself a real job. I like a person with heart. We could do way worse than choosing somebody to follow. Back in 60 seconds, Jack turned his microphone toward the bus interior to give his audience the sound of the ambient bus noise, low-toned conversations, the bus changing gears, the wheels whizzing. Okay, here we are, almost. Jack gave his listeners an on-the-scene oral travelogue of the road as he fidgeted with his thin black laptop. Okay, just about. Here we go. Folks, what you're about to hear now is a tape recording of children dying in Iraq in a makeshift hospital during the attack by United States Boys Next Door. The tape was sent to me by a friend, passed him from, well, who knows where. You know that one country singer? Not the Patriots, the Dixie Chicks, but that Nazi one, the corporate government boy. You know, the one on the Ford commercials. Got a song about being American and a soldier and putting a boot up their ass. Wonder what it'd be like to have that song playing on the country channel with photos of dead kids in Iraq. You know. The ones with no legs, blood pouring out their stomachs onto the dirt street. Put a boot up their ass. Ford commercials. Dead kids. American soldier. Television. local country radio station, America. A young boy perched on his knees in the seat behind Jack, his arms over Jack's headrest. Another boy and girl stood in the aisle next to Jack, listening. The bus driver looked in the big mirror at the children's parents, and they told the kids to kneel in the aisle if they were going to listen to the radio show. Now, we're going to do something here, people. This is going out again. As you know, I'm looking for Bigfoot Radio, an exclusive, as they say, from some bus on some lonely stretch of road. Jack Robert King on the Looking for Bigfoot tour with FBI agents in the seats around me and a little red Toyota following. Some white planes and helicopters without markings overhead, not to mention the state patrol cars of the various states giving us a howdy-do as we pass. My family's huddling around the computer at home, wondering if the next sound they hear will be dead air. We're out to prove that Bigfoot exists and truth can be found in America. It's like we got us a convoy. I'm going to play this tape of these crying children who've been shot and bombed by the all-star halfbacks and quarterbacks and second basemen of high schools across the United States. This is what getting up at 6 a.m. to run wind sprints and lift weights and listening to the national anthem each morning before school, that's what it gets us. Play this tape here. I'm going to background the words of Toby Keith, an American celebrity. We're going to get us a better idea of where our spotless Sunday school attendance has gotten us.
The tape began with automatic weapons fire, loud cries, wailing, someone shouting in Arabic very fast, perhaps saying, "Get a doctor over here." And the response, just as rapid, just as recognizable, even in another language, "There is no doctor. Take care of it yourself." Jack Robert King spoke over the tape.
American girls and American guys will always stand up and salute. We'll always recognize when we see Old Glory flying. There's a lot of men dead, so we can sleep in peace at night when we lay down our head.
More screams, the scraping of metal on concrete as if beds are being dragged into place, more hurried, frightened talk. "We are in an Iraqi open space, ER. Where is the mother, the father? They are gone. Their child is burned. We cannot treat her here."
As soon as we could see clearly through our big black eye, then we lit up your world like the 4th of July.
"Ah, no, 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 no." A siren cries out on the tape and a bomb goes off somewhere. You can feel the makeshift hospital building shake. Everything silent for a split moment, and the cries and the hurried voices begin again.
Uncle Sam put your name in the top of his list. The Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist.
"More bandages. Get bandages. This boy is dead. Get him out of here. Bring in the others. Are there others outside? Bring them in. Bring them in. Hurry, hurry. Hurry, hurry, please. Ah!"
"It's going to be hell, like the world's raining down on you. Brought to you courtesy of the red, white, and blue."
"Oh, it hurts. It hurts my leg. No, 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 please."
"Justice will be served. The battle will rage. This big dog will fight when you rattle his cage. You'll be sorry you messed with the U.S. of A."
"This one is dead too. Oh my God. How many are there? We need more doctors, more stretchers. Are they still bombing? Ha! Ah, mommy, make it stop. It hurts. It hurts. Ah, daddy, ah!"
"'Cause we'll put a boot up your ass. It's the American way."
Jack let the tape play out with more screams, more rushing about, more hollering. Emergency personnel and civilians attempting triage. The howling of sirens, honking horns, scattered single shots. And then silence. And then the on-air sound melded to the bus noise once again.
"This is Looking for Bigfoot Radio. May Allah bless you tonight, partner."
And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO country singers are about average.
And that wraps up another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we hope you'll be back again, same time, same place, next week. We'd like to thank WorldNewsTrust.com, TheSpiritualUN.org, and June2508.com, all of whom helped to sponsor our show. I'd like to thank you, Mike. Good night.
Good night, Chuck. Stay warm. Good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.